Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, this is our first in a series I'm calling The Honest Election Chronicles, where we are going state by state, looking at how voting irregularities occur in our elections. We want every legal vote to count, but only the legal ones, not the votes of the people who voted twice, once by absentee ballot, once in person, not the people who moved out of state and voted anyway, not the voting machines who were tasked with matching signatures, yet they lowered the standard so they really don't need to match perfectly. Many of us are trying to separate what evidence is real and what is simply unfounded. Each state has faced unique challenges in the 2020 election, particularly with the extraordinary increase in absentee ballots due to the virus. In Georgia, the race between President Trump and Vice President Biden was very close. Even after a six-day hand recount, they only differed by 12,284 votes in favor of Biden, an extraordinarily close margin. And the race in Georgia isn't over. We move on to two Senate runoff elections in January that will determine the Democrat or Republican control of the U.S. Senate. My guest today understand Georgia politics inside and out. I'm pleased to welcome my guests, David Schaefer, chairman of the Georgia Republican Party, and Lindsey Rutter, who is a candidate for state representative for Georgia House District 54. I'm really pleased to welcome my guest and good friend, David Schaefer, the chairman of the Georgia Republican Party. He has done an amazing job, and he's in the middle of one of the most amazing complexities I've ever seen in a long time in politics. Let's start at the basics, Dave. For people who may not be fully up with what's going on, tell us what's actually happening in Georgia.
Well, we're trying to get to a point where we can certify the results of the presidential race. The election was a week and a half ago. The Secretary of State's not certified the returns yet because he's in the middle of conducting an audit where they will hand count all of the paper ballots and compare that count against the machine count to determine whether or not the machines accurately counted the votes. The audit was supposed to be finished last night at midnight, but the large urban counties had not yet completed their work, and the secretary gave them an extension until today at noon. And so we expect to have the results of the audit either later this afternoon or tomorrow morning, and then the secretary should likely certify the returns.
Some people think it's very deep problems. Other people just think that it's kind of noise. What's your sense from what you see looking around the state?
There are significant irregularities with the election and significant weaknesses that have been revealed in our progress. I told you exactly where we're at. I haven't told you every complaint that we have had with the process. The irregularities became apparent to me on election night, when there was a significant number of ballots counted in secret. Georgia law requires that vote counting be done in the open, that any member of the public can attend, and also allows the parties to credential observers or monitors to watch that process. At State Farm Arena, the Fulton County elections officials announced that they would stop counting at 10:30 and resume at 8:30 the next morning. They packed up all of their belongings. Our observers left, the news media left, and once they were gone, they began counting again and counted until 1 in the morning outside the observation of anyone. Now, people will say to me, well, can you prove that any fraud took place during that, you know, three-hour period of time? And the answer is, of course not, because it was done in secret. We weren't allowed to observe it. And, you know, we encountered those problems in other counties as well. There's a mechanism under Georgia law called the vote review panel. Using an absentee ballot when you can't discern what the intent of the voter was, these absentee ballots are hand completed and then scanned through machines. If the machine is unable to read it, then three people, including one Democrat and one Republican, are supposed to review each ballot and determine how it should be counted. We've got sworn affidavits from eight different counties where these vote review panels would meet without notice or participation from the Republican members. We have filed numerous complaints with the Secretary of State. He's launched at least two investigations that we're aware of, but none of that inspires much confidence in the electoral process.
Well, and you had sort of surprise to me, you had counties like Walton and Fayette and Floyd finding new votes.
That's happened during the audit process. During the hand count, we had Floyd County found 2,700 votes that were not scanned and counted on election day. No explanation as to what happened. 2,500 votes in Fayette County discovered. No real explanation as to what happened in Walton County too, and in Douglas County as well. And those aren't even the big urban counties where we historically have all of the problems. Those counties have not yet reported. I will tell you, in DeKalb County, Georgia, on Sunday, one of our observers of the hand count, one of our concerns is that in this audit process, we've been limited to one monitor for every 10 counting tables, which does not give us a meaningful opportunity to watch what is happening. But one of our monitors in DeKalb County stumbled upon a batch of votes that was labeled 10,707 for Joe Biden and 13 for Donald Trump, which is a margin of victory that rivals third world dictators in sham elections. So he questioned it, and they determined that the box only contained about 1,000 ballots. They recounted it, and the actual margin was only 1,081 votes for Joe Biden and 13 votes for Donald Trump. And so an over 9,000 vote discrepancy that, had we not caught it, would have added 9,000 votes to Joe Biden's margin when the audit was completed. But it had been signed off by two official counters from DeKalb County and would not have been discovered but for this Republican observer happening upon him. Again, so, something that doesn't inspire any confidence in the electoral process.
Once you go through certification, can you then demand an actual recount?
The Secretary of State's described this as a recount, and other politicians and media figures have described what we're going through right now as a recount, but it's really not a recount. It's a hand count as part of an audit of machines. Once the returns are certified, then any candidate whose margin is close enough can request a recount. You know, we anticipate the president will request a recount, or if Biden is down after the returns are certified, that he would request one. There may be other recounts requested in the U.S. Senate race, which was very close, and the Georgia Public Service Commission race was very close. Those have to be requested within 2 days of certification, and then they would begin almost immediately. And instead of hand counting the paper ballots would be rescanned through the machines, and then that recount would be certified.
So what about challenging the ballots?
If a ballot is kicked out by the machine, there is a voter review panel process that's in place where each of the ballots is examined. Another issue that's arisen is the number of absentee ballots and the lack of verification on the front end. And there's actually, as we speak, a hearing in federal court happening right now where the signature verification process for those absentee ballots is being challenged, and how that hearing goes will have a great impact on how things play out here in Georgia. Historically, absentee ballots, which are ballots that are sent in by mail, make up about 5 to 6% of the ballots cast. And there's not photo identification required by anyone casting an absentee ballot. Instead, the signatures and other information from the application is supposed to be verified, and if it passes, an actual ballot is mailed out, and if it's not verified, then it's rejected. In this election, because of the pandemic, there were almost 7 times as many absentee ballots requested and issued, and concerns have been raised whether or not that verification process worked under such a great volume. On September 30th, the Georgia Republican Party asked for an opportunity to watch the verification process take place, and we were not allowed to do so.
What was the Secretary of State's argument for not letting you do it?
They said that the original voter registration card contained some information that was not public information, and they were worried that our observers would peer over the shoulders of the employees doing the verification and look at this confidential information. And we had a conference call with the senior staff of the Secretary of State's office on September 30th, walked through how we could do that, addressing that concern. They agreed to do it. They agreed to issue a bulletin to the counties saying that we were allowed to do this, but the bulletin was never sent. They reversed themselves some time after that.
So you have a Republican Secretary of State blocking the Republican Party.
It is very frustrating. I personally like Brad Raffensperger, and I don't believe that he is a witting participant in wrongdoing, but he has become a defender of the system when he's supposed to be the overseer of the system. I mean, the elections are all conducted by county election superintendents. Most of the county election superintendents do a pretty good job. There's really only about 6 or 7 large counties where we have all of the problems every 2 years. And I'd like to see Raffensperger go after those counties aggressively, trying to correct these problems so they don't reoccur, as opposed to positioning himself as the apologist for all of the sloppiness.
You know what the market hates? Uncertainty. What is more uncertain than a presidential election that hasn't been decided? No one knows which way this is going to go. So you have a very limited time to get in front of this, to get ahead of an economic meltdown. Now is the time to protect your investments, your savings, your retirement. It's time to diversify a portion of your savings into gold or silver with Birch Gold Group. This is the company to trust. Birch Gold will help you legally convert any eligible IRA or 401k into a precious metals IRA, or just buy gold or silver to lock in your personal safe. Text NEWT to 474747. Get a free info kit on diversifying into gold, and then call Birch Gold. These guys are the best. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and countless 5-star reviews. Text NEWT to 474747 and open a precious metals IRA and secure your savings today. Again, text NEWT to 474747. I want to go back just for 1 second, because I saw the numbers about the 10,000 vote discrepancy, but somebody said that it had actually been reconciled. So it didn't actually affect Biden's lead.
So had that error not been caught, Biden's lead would have increased by 9,000 votes.
Ah, I see.
I mean, it's astonishing. They claim that this is proof that the system works. Well, it's proof of the opposite. The official counters, two of them signed off on the wrong count, and it was only discovered by the Republican Observer, who had to engage in an argument before they agreed several hours later to recount the batch and produce the correct number. Had that not been corrected, then Biden's numbers would have been boosted by 9,000, would have canceled out all of the legitimate gains made by President Trump in Floyd and Fayette and right. Walton County. The way that the news media has spun these things is astonishing and discouraging to me. There's this absolute lack of curiosity into how our elections are being conducted, because their overriding concern seems to be that President Trump is defeated. And it really doesn't matter what sloppiness or irregularity or wrongdoing happened. They don't want that discussed until they're absolutely certain that President Trump is gone.
In terms of, for example, the counties that came in that improved President Trump's position, did they also improve David Perdue's position?
Probably. I mean, logically they would. They're only hand counting ballots in the presidential race for the purposes of the audit. Obviously, someone who voted for President Trump almost certainly voted for David Perdue, so his position is likely better.
Wasn't he close to winning without a runoff?
Yes, but it was approximately the same margin as the president's margin. He probably will request a recount, and then the ballots in his race will be rescanned and probably a corrected return certified.
So you're talking about the media. I noticed that Twitter just put a disputed label on one of your tweets. How much censorship have you run into for other people in the Georgia campaign?
I think this is the first time one of my tweets has been flagged as disputed. And what's ironic is that the Secretary of State confirmed the accuracy of the tweet, and that was reported in the news media, and Twitter labeled it as disputed information anyway. That's a whole separate set of problems with how information is communicated in America.
And you have historically always had the problem of the Atlanta newspaper being pretty consistently anti-Republican.
Yeah, absolutely left-leaning. It's not as powerful of an institution as when you were active in Georgia politics, but the problems that it caused back then are now being caused by other media that has replaced it.
In my own experience, in 1992, I was in a tough election campaign. They attacked me for 19 out of 23 days. I was beginning to think they didn't like me. I cheerfully campaigned anyway. I worry a lot that if we can't fix some of this, that we can focus on the campaign for the runoff, but the Democrats will focus on the election. And no matter how good our campaign, we could end up losing the state pretty much the way they've operated on this round. What's your sense about how vulnerable we are to a repeat of various ballot problems, et cetera, when we get to the runoff in January?
I'm concerned about it. If there's the same large percentage of absentee ballots again, you know, to where we have a third of the votes being counted, not having been identified at least to the same level as people who vote in person, I think that's a threat to the integrity of the election. The truth of the matter is that this sloppiness and these errors happen in every single election, and they're ignored because the elections are not really ever close. And for the longest time in Georgia, the Democrats dominated things. For most of the last 18 years, the Republicans have dominated things. But we're about to enter a period of time here in Georgia where every election will be close. And if we don't secure it, it may be difficult for us to ever to win any.
I think that's right. And that's why I'm very concerned in this very short timeline this fall with figuring out whatever we can do to have an honest, clear count and an honest election. Because it does seem to me that that threatens both Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler, that they could run a great campaign, but it wouldn't matter because the votes would somehow magically show up. Isn't it also true, by the way, that people who are going to move into the state just long enough to vote, isn't that actually illegal?
In order to register in the state, you have to be a resident, so you have to intend to live here permanently. I wrote a 5-page letter to Raffensperger, packed full of examples of various left-wing figures throughout the country encouraging people to vacation in Georgia or move here temporarily to register and vote in the election, which is plainly illegal. Now, to their credit, the Attorney General and the Secretary of State both made clear that was a felony that would be investigated, and I think that has largely shut down that effort.
That's great. Well, listen, I appreciate very much your leadership in a very challenging and a very difficult period. And I just want to encourage you, these next couple of months are literally vital to the future of the country. And those two Senate seats are that important, I think. So thank you as a citizen for all you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all you do as well, and appreciate the opportunity to be with you today on this podcast.
Lindsay Rutter was a candidate for state representative for Georgia House District 54. So we're going to deal, first of all, with how is Georgia turning blue, or is it turning blue? Stacey Abrams served for 11 years in the Georgia House of Representatives, 7 as the Democratic leader. And in 2018, Stacey became the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. After losing the race to now Governor Brian Kemp, Abrams formed a Fair Fight. Can you tell us, Lindsay, how Stacey Abrams' organization, Fair Fight, has worked to transform the state of Georgia?
Yes, Fair Fight Action started in around 2014, and at the time, it was very quietly put together. She was working kind of behind the scenes. Of course, now it's an organization that's probably known not just in Georgia, but nationally. And what she's really done successfully is, in my opinion, has several arms to Fair Fight Action. First and foremost, it's really been a nonprofit legal arm focused on challenging any type of what she alleges to be voter restrictions, what some might call voter integrity laws. And she's challenging those throughout the state. And in addition to that, that she's widening the door to voting, she is second, a very strong grassroots movement. And as she's registering new voters, as she's finding new pockets of voters, those doors are opened wider for voters to come through. And then third, she's really trying to transform policy and different legislation around the voting acts in our state and then, of course, nationally as well. And you're seeing the results of that. And while it may not be the result that many Republicans are happy about today, she has done some very hard work, and she has, quite frankly, done it successfully.
You're an attorney by training, and you've worked as a professional as an attorney. You're currently a deputy district attorney in Atlanta. You also ran for the Georgia House Representatives for District 54 in this election cycle. Given all that background, both legally and politically, what issues have you discovered with Georgia's voting rules?
Well, first, what I would say as a candidate is you're traditionally focused on fundraising, meeting your voters, spreading your message and getting your vote out and picking up new votes. What I think has been very telling from this election cycle is something that candidates have not traditionally had to focus on is now going to be something that should be key to every election. And that's really the fidelity and integrity of a voter list. That's something that candidates have just taken as the voter list. And now I think it's something that needs to be critically examined and needs to be looked at by every candidate. You can't just presume that it's an accurate list that's maintained in real time. And so that's been one of the biggest takeaways I have taken from this experience as a lawyer and with my background and as a candidate running at District 54, which is primarily Buckhead and Atlanta, Georgia, a very transient area of Georgia.
As you see all that, have they actually been purging the rolls, or do they just let people stay on them forever?
The states are allowed to maintain their own voter rolls, of course. Nationally, there was a statute put in place in 1993 under former President Bill Clinton and a democratically controlled Congress. The code check section is 52 USCS 20507, but it's more commonly known as the National Voter Registration Act, or NVRA for abbreviation. And essentially what it says, in addition to many other parts, is that in any election cycle that has a federal candidate or a federal election on the ballot, there are restrictions on what a state can do in terms of purging or cleaning their voter rolls. Georgia is absolutely free to determine who might be ineligible on a Georgia voter registration list due to moving out of state or out of the area. However, they're not allowed, upon identifying that, to immediately purge anyone. They have to send notice to those potentially ineligible voters via a postcard to the prior address in Georgia. Presumably, that voter doesn't live in Georgia anymore and won't respond. Lack of a response is still not enough to purge them according to this federal law. You have to wait two federal election cycles thereafter to be able to remove them, which at its shortest term would be 4 years. Atlanta, where I was running, in Buckhead, it's a very transient area. People move in and out every year for work. Within 4 years, you're going to have a lot of people on that list that no longer live here. But unfortunately, the states are restrained by this federal code section that prevents them from purging.
So in a sense, that requires changing federal law.
It would.
It's a system that clearly needs to be cleaned up.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that is very concerning to me is Speaker Nancy Pelosi has stated that if they maintain both chambers of Congress, House Bill 1 will be one of the first bills that she introduces, which amongst many progressive provisions in that, the most concerning to me is an outlaw on any cleaning or purging of voter rolls. And so if that were to pass, we would see what we're seeing now on tremendously larger scales, and that is going to undermine the integrity of any and every voting list. And so it's an extreme concern. You know, I can't speak to what the state list looks like, but I can tell you as a candidate and my smaller race within Fulton County, what my voter rolls looked like, because I did do analysis on those to get an image of what the current status of the voters on my list were. And it was very telling.
When you went door to door, what did you learn from the reality versus the voters list that you had?
As a candidate, canvassing is a large part of a local campaign, making voter contact. And so what myself and my team did is we went to the Secretary of State's office for Georgia, and we downloaded the list of registered voters to determine which ones were registered to vote in Fulton County. And inside Fulton County, there are multiple districts. So we were just looking at my district within Fulton County, House District 54, and we selected the potential voters in that district. And then we picked a universe of voters who I wanted to introduce myself to and meet, and set out on what they call a walkbook, a list of, you know, 50 different addresses in a neighborhood, and probably interacted with about 10,000 voters. We hit over, goodness, 4,000 or 5,000 doors, and so you just go door to door. Now, as I did that, what was very interesting to me, and I'll give you a few examples, one point, I had a targeted voter. So it was a voter listed on the Secretary of State's webpage. Let's just call him John Doe. And it stated his address was 123 Main Street, Apartment B. So I arrive at this address, and this is a very prestigious neighborhood in Buckhead, one of the more wealthier neighborhoods in the entire state. And I arrive at a residence that's a, quite frankly, a mansion, a single family home. There is no apartment. It's not a duplex. There are not two mailboxes. There is no one residing in an apartment at that location. And there are anomalies like that that just continue to repeat themselves. Another one would be, you would see on the voter registration roll that you were going to another house, let's call it 456 Main Street, and there are two sets of families residing in that home. And so you have two families with different last names with ages that appear to be two sets of parents and children. And that was very odd to me. And so I questioned, is this the prior owners of this home that just have not been updated in the voter files, or is this fraud where someone's registered other people at this home? Why is this so? Because these are not neighborhoods that would have made sense to have two families residing in them. I think one of the third and final anomalies is you would have an address. We'll call this one 678 Main Street. You get to it. There's no home. It's a field. It's a home's been torn down, and you have a family registered at that address or a person at that address. Now, could it be that that was the former owner? They sold the home to someone else who's knocked down the home and rebuilding? Maybe. But it was these anomalies that started to really concern me. And around that same time, separate from canvassing, I received a jury summons to my home address, my personal address, and the name of an individual who's never resided in distress who I do not know. And that was very concerning to me because I suspected that someone had either registered to vote or registered to drive in my address. And that is how you would end up on a jury list in Fulton County. You either registered to drive or registered to vote at an address within a county. And that's how you would end up on a jury list. But it was very concerning to me seeing all these and adding these pieces up. And I would add last that I took a list of voters who lived in apartment complexes that due to COVID, I was unable to enter the premises of their apartment or condo buildings to knock on their door. So I started to call them. And I would say on a list of about 100, maybe only 10 would actually answer. You'd have a low return rate. And many of the other numbers, about 90%, go to numbers that have been disconnected, phone numbers that do not have voicemails or personalized messages that have been set up. And it became very concerning to me that either these people were temporarily here and no longer here and seemed to have data in the voter files that were outdated.
On October 30th, as a candidate, you pulled the early voting results. I didn't know you could do that, actually. What does that mean?
Since we had early voting for 3 weeks in Georgia and the majority of the votes being cast, either early vote or an absentee, many of the votes had already been sent to the Georgia Secretary of State's office by October 30th, the eve of the November 3rd election. And those were uploaded into the Secretary of State's webpage, so you could download the list of people who have already voted in your race. And so as of Friday morning, the last day of early voting before the general election, there were roughly 38,000 people who were uploaded as already voting in my district, House District 54. And based on my background litigating jury issues that somewhat derive from our voter files, seeing on the ground the anomalies that I pointed out, making phone calls to newly registered voters, I really started to consider the integrity of the 38,000 people that had already voted in my race. And I decided, although it was the eve of the election, I hired a statistician, an expert who's done this many times, who specializes in this. If he would take the 38,000 voters who had already voted in my race, so it wouldn't be all the votes cast, but the ones cast so far, and would he do analysis of who these voters are, where they actually reside? And there's a process that's accepted legally in courts. And essentially what you do is you take the set of voters and you cross-reference that with what's called the National Change of Address Database. That is a database maintained by the United States Postal Service. And if, for example, one of your viewers were to move from House A to House B, and they want their mail forwarded, they would do a change of address with the Postal Service. And the Postal Service will note that change of address and put the new address in the National Change of Address database. And roughly about 30% of the country, it's really 27%, actually ever do that. But it will give you an image of where people are actually residing. So the first thing we did was take my 38,000 voters and we ran it against the National Change of Address database to see, have any of my voters, the 38,000, recently in the last year, some 30 days, some 60 days, 90 days, done a National Change of Address indicating that they do not live in my county or the state of Georgia. But due to the fact that, as I mentioned, only 30% of the country actually does this, there are other databases you can use to determine where someone resides. Those are databases and vendors that maintain where someone pays their utilities, where someone has their magazines come. Because while they may not tell the post office that they're moving, they're going to tell the Wall Street Journal, they're going to tell their magazine subscriptions, they're going to tell their utility companies, they're going to make sure they have their homestead exemption in a specific state where they're actually residing. You can run the list against those. And we did that. And the combination of the two searches was quite telling. In my race, we had 1,582 voters who had a change of address or started to pay their utilities in a zip code that was outside of my district. So they may have lived in Fulton County, but not within my district. So going a step further, we found that there was 1,079 voters with a new zip code outside of Fulton County. Their zip code did not place them within the county. Maybe they were in a surrounding metro county. And then most telling to what's happening on a national scale, we found that there were 646 voters with a zip code placing them outside the state of Georgia. It was not a Georgia zip code.
So given all your experiences and the fact you've been both a candidate and an attorney, what can people do as Georgians to protect the vote?
I would recommend that if you're aware of any voter fraud, you can go to the Georgia Secretary of State's webpage, and they have a voter fraud link, and you can report it. And I think being, you know, very cognizant, diligent, and respectful of the voting booth is crucial, and we all have to remember that the right to vote is one of our most fundamental aspects that makes us American.
I agree with you. And I should say, for anybody who's listening, if they have knowledge of voter fraud, please report it at Gingrich360.com/honest-elections. That's Gingrich360.com/honest-elections. I want to thank you for how knowledgeable you are and for the courage you've shown to run. And I hope that you will stay active in the political system and help us not only clean up this mess, but solve the many challenges that Americans are faced with. And I really do appreciate very much, Lindsay, your willingness to come on and to talk about your experiences.
Well, thank you so much. It was a tremendous honor to get to speak with you, and thank you for everything you've done for our country and continue to do. I'm going to stay involved. I'm very passionate about this and digging deeper in to our voter issues and making sure we have lists that the fidelity and integrity of them are maintained.
Thank you to my guests, David Schaefer and Lindsay Rutter. You can read more about the Georgia presidential election and the U.S. Senate runoff elections on our show page at newtsworld.com. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. This may be the most confusing inner circle gathering we've had so far, and that's because I have never seen such an amazing mess. If you follow our podcast, we've just begun a series I'm calling The Honest Election Chronicles. Yesterday, we interviewed three people from Nevada, where I am totally convinced that the Democratic legislature and the Democratic governor conspired in the spring to steal the state and did so by passing laws which make corruption legal. And I think it's going to require federal involvement to protect the rights, just as it did during the age of segregation, when local states adopted laws that blocked African-Americans from voting. Right now, the Democrats in Nevada have decided to steal the state with no regard for the rest of the United States or those citizens who are independents and Republican who don't agree. There are an estimated 600,000 votes that no Republican has seen. And under the current state law that they adopted this spring, there's no provision for them to ever be able to get there, no matter what. So clearly, that can't stand. You cannot have an entire state in a presidential election or a Senate or House election, any federal election, taken off the board by the local corrupt political machine. The second example, we just did two interviews with people in Georgia. I've spent a lot of time in Georgia. As you know, I was the congressman from there for 20 years. My daughter, Jackie Cushman, still lives there. We have an enormous number of friends there. I believe that the margin by which Biden is carrying the state is about three times as many votes that were absentee ballots that should not have been counted as his margin. So I think that's the second area. And that then, of course, bleeds over into two U.S. Senate races. And I believe if we don't fix Georgia's election law, that the two Senate races will be stolen. You'll end up, no matter how good the Republican campaign is, no matter how good the advertising is, on election night, magically, enough votes will show up to elect the two Democrats, no matter how unpopular they are. So I think Georgia becomes the second example. Ronna McDaniel, the Republican National Committee chair, who used to be the Michigan State Republican chair, said last night, and I talked to her about it today, that in Detroit, 72% of the precincts could not validate their records until magically at the very end, everything got fixed late at night. And she said, now, in 2018, it was 80% of the precincts in Detroit. They'd say, for example, oh, we sent out 100 absentee ballots. Oh, and look, 200 came in. And there's no effort to try to figure out what's gone wrong there. So just taking that alone in the largest city in Michigan would be enough to assume that we're talking about a pretty large scale corruption. On top of that, I think we have to look at what's happening in Pennsylvania, where Philadelphia may be the most corrupt city in the country. And then finally, we have to look at Wisconsin, where the Wisconsin Election Commission just totally ignored two court orders. And I think there's some evidence that as many as 200,000 votes may have been involved in things that the Wisconsin Election Commission did that aren't legal or appropriate. So you look around all this, and it comes on top of the fact that, for example, Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, has given away $400 million for turnout, and his foundation happened to only give it to counties that Hillary Clinton carried. So he was disproportionately engaged in helping turnout using foundation money, not political money, foundation money. He happened to be in favor of turnout only where there are going to be voters who favored Biden and not voters who favored Trump. And he's back already in Georgia, putting in more millions of dollars into turnout. Then you have the internet companies, which have been routinely censoring conservatives, censoring people who question the elections. Then you have the news media, which has sustained its 93% anti-Trump attitude, and which has routinely refused to cover all the different examples that in a normal year, with this many things normally going wrong, you'd have a very different tone in the news media. But they are so desperate to defeat Trump that just as they don't want to cover Hunter Biden, who, by the way, had a Senate committee report come out yesterday saying that he was doing things in China, he was doing things in Russia, and that Joe Biden knew it, which would have been page one if it had been one of the Trump family. But because of their desperation to protect Biden, they managed to smother as much negative news as they can. And you have these interestingly diverse data points. The Republicans in the House did very well. The Democrats and most of the left-wing analysts thought that the Democrats would pick up 15 seats. I think the Republicans are going to pick up at least 10 and maybe more, and they may end up with a 5 or 6 seat margin for the Democrats, which will make it very hard for Pelosi to get anything serious done. When Bill Clinton won, 2 years later, we picked up 54 seats and won control for the first time since 1954, first time in 40 years. Then when Obama won, 2 years later, with John Boehner's leadership, we picked up 63 seats. And I raised the question, you know, I don't know whether Biden will be bad enough that we get 60 seats or 50 seats. But you're almost guaranteed historically that Kevin McCarthy is going to be the next speaker and will be sworn in January of 2023. This is compounded by the fact that we are confronted with big Republican gains in the state legislature around the country. We have picked up a governorship, great election for the House, great election for the state legislature. It's a very tough year in terms of how many Republicans and how many Democrats were up. But if we win the two Georgia seats, we'll be in good shape with a 52-48 Republican margin, and Mitch McConnell will remain the majority leader. That's going to be an uphill fight, and I'll come back to that. If you look at the referendums, almost every referendum in almost every state, unless it related to legalizing marijuana, almost every referendum, the conservatives won and liberals lost, including in California. So there are underlying patterns building that actually look very good for us. And of course, President Trump got more votes than any president in history and more votes than anybody except Biden. So it's not exactly like he was unpopular. And one has to wonder how many of Biden's votes are actually not real. And I think that's part of what these five contested states are all about. Let me also say that I think the initial indications from the Biden appointments are it's going to be a very left-wing administration. They've appointed somebody to the transition team at Treasury who is passionately in favor of reparations for African Americans and would spend billions and billions of dollars setting up what I think is an impossible system. They have appointed as the deputy chief of staff somebody who had worked to confiscate guns or have compulsory purchase of guns, so you'd have to sell it to the government and you wouldn't be allowed to own it. They have other people actively engaged with them who have very radical ideas, including eliminating any federal aid to any school that has a religious belief, and in fact, even discrediting it on the grounds that religious beliefs are antithetical to the gay and lesbian movement, which is the primary, it's the group who are pushing that. It's going to be a very interesting time to watch and see what happens. I spend, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day just trying to catch up with the news because I'm looking for hints. I'm looking for indicators of where we're going and what's happening. I've said publicly, I don't think the president should concede yet. I think every day that goes by, we're learning more about what went wrong. And I think it's very important. When I say went wrong, I don't mean the campaign. I mean the election. And I think it's very important that we learn all of this. I'm considering doing a book on the reforms we need to have honest elections, because if we don't have honest elections, we're in desperate trouble. Your right to hire and fire the people to whom you loan power is central to our whole system. It's central to what we mean by freedom. And if we're going to go back to a period where the Tammany Hall type machines, where they dominate, then your freedom is basically gone. And you now are at the mercy of corrupt politicians. So I think this is a very big deal. I am not at all comfortable with where we are right now, but I think that it's a topic we're going to continue to explore and we'll continue to report to you about it. And of course, you go from there to the economy, to international relations, to China, to technological and scientific advances. We're entering a period where there'll be lots and lots to talk about, a lot to look at, and it's not going to slow down. If anything, we may actually see more changes in the next 4 years from all the different factors around the world. Debbie, I know you have a whole bunch of questions that have already come in, and I thought we'd start there, and then we'll go and just open the mics and let people ask questions. But do you have some that have already been sent in?
Oh, yeah. The large outpouring that we saw this last week from members that are expressing their anger, their frustration, and their desire to get involved. So Anise from Nevada summed it up beautifully. She said, "I'm feeling powerless. Why is it that the Republicans let the Democrats get away with so much? Is there nothing we can do? What can we do to get involved or make a difference?"
Well, I think, first of all, you can get involved in the politics of Nevada. I got involved actively in 1960 in Georgia when I was a junior in high school. And there was no Georgia Republican Party. Today, we have every statewide office plus the majority of the House members plus control of both the House and Senate. So over time, you can have a huge impact. Ultimately, the Nevada Democratic Party is a creature of the unions in Las Vegas. I think ultimately they can't, in the end, run the state very well. And I would encourage you to get involved in your local party and get involved in helping candidates, maybe run yourself if you're willing to. That's how you change things. It's a hard business, but it's a pretty straightforward business, and everybody can come and play.
This is one a lot of people wrote in, and you may not know the answer to it, but it was overarchingly our second most popular one. The news is so conflicting regarding a Trump strategy to win. Do you still see that there's a way to do so? And what would that be?
Well, I think there's two key factors here. I personally believe Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia are all in play. I think it's uphill partially because of the court's reluctance. But remember, in four of those five states, in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, you have a Republican majority in both the House and the Senate. And in a recent judgment involving a Wisconsin case, we had a justice who wrote very clearly that the Constitution gives the power over federal elections to the state legislature, not the governor, not the courts, not the Secretary of State. I've been advocating publicly that the Georgia legislature should reconvene itself, even if the governor doesn't call them, just call themselves in. And they should establish an overview to insist on a complete vote count. It is the legislature, technically, which appoints the electors. And I think in these four states, we have a majority Republican. They ought to say flatly, they are not going to appoint any electors until they are convinced that there's been an honest and complete recount in which every single ballot has been checked. And we're sure that every legal voter has voted, but no illegal voters. At the same time, I think the federal government has to get involved in Nevada, because there you have a state which has literally legalized corruption. And I think it's intolerable. And I think we have a clear right, but also would be legitimate for a governor of another state to sue the state of Nevada on the grounds that their illegitimate election weakens and dilutes the effectiveness of the governor's state. And that would go straight to the Supreme Court. If one state sues another, it goes straight to the Supreme Court. But I get a sense Justice Alito is very angry, has given speeches publicly about how angry he is and how much he thinks that the local politicians have ignored the court and ignored the law. Now, I think that Justice Kavanaugh wrote this very strong footnote in Wisconsin saying unequivocally, if you read the Constitution, it says it is the state legislatures, not the governors, not the courts, not the Secretary of State. I believe that it's very likely that Gorsuch and Barrett would agree with them, because as original constructionists, just pull out your Constitution and read that section. It is so clear that it's impossible to argue anything else. Now, it also has a very interesting twist, which I don't think they'll go to, but it would certainly cause massive confusion. The Constitution actually says the election will occur on one day. The Constitution actually doesn't have any provision for mail-in ballots or any provision for 45-day long elections. It says the legislature shall hold the election on one day. And as originalists, it'll be fascinating to see what they would do if they got a case like that. I would also point out that I think Justice Thomas would be very interested in this kind of case. So I suspect you could get a potential 5-4 vote or 6-3 vote in favor of the state legislatures having their constitutional duty. But then the legislatures, who've all gotten slow and soft, and this isn't their kind of business, they've got to learn what their power is and what their responsibility is, and they've got to step up to the plate and do it. And so I would say to anybody who's listening to us in Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania, call on your state legislators and ask them to set up a system to supervise all of this and to make sure that they are totally satisfied that the election was honest, before they agree to send in any electors.
Mr. Jordan asks, is the information regarding the Dominion software that Sidney Powell's been talking about sufficient for Trump to succeed by January 20th? And do you know if it's true? Have we seen evidence?
I respect Sidney Powell. She wrote a remarkable book called License to Lie, which was about the Justice Department's mistreatment of people. She's done a very, very good job for General Flynn. And the times I've interacted with Sidney, she's very professional and very, very smart. But I do think there's a point where you got to show what you got. And I wish if she does have this evidence, I wish she'd bring it out. We have a project underway at Gingrich 360 where we're candidly, we're trying to understand this stuff, but it is very murky. I will tell you this, though. One of the election reforms I'm going to recommend, if I do end up writing a book on election law, is going to be that you not have any firm which takes your votes outside the United States. Apparently, the votes were going through Barcelona, Spain, to Frankfurt, Germany to be counted. There are several of these companies, but the one that had the most states was doing all the vote counting outside the United States. And in this day and age, if you ask me, do I trust any system which is on the internet? My answer is no. I don't mind a computer that's isolated and off the internet. But if it's on the internet, it is subject to hacking. And if you look at the quality of Russian and Chinese hackers, or for that matter, the quality of the best American hackers, the idea that these things are safe, I think, is lunacy. I'm not saying that they necessarily were used to steal the election for Biden. I'm just saying that the basic construct of the system is profoundly wrong, which is why, for example, the state of Texas turned down buying the Dominion equipment.
Eleanor wants your opinion on a Breitbart article where in an interview with Stacey Abrams by Jake Tapper, she believes the Democrats can absolutely fill both Senate seats in the runoff in January. What's your opinion on that?
I think she may be right. I take very seriously the danger that we could lose those two seats and you could have Senator Schumer as majority leader, which would lead to gun confiscation. It would lead to tax increases. It would lead to the District of Columbia getting two U.S. senators. Just go down the list. It would lead probably to packing the court. It would certainly lead to efforts, I think, to dramatically roll back our liberties. So I take very seriously how big a deal this is. I hope by January 5th that we've gotten the message out and that they're back up and running. But I'm very concerned about the two Senate seats in Georgia.
Leon from Virginia is a retired U.S. Naval intelligence officer who worked for the Naval Investigative Services in D.C. His job was to run special background investigations for individuals seeking very high security clearances. His question is, the president has to have the above top secret level of clearances. So given Vice President Biden's dealings with the Ukraine and Communist China, how could he ever be granted this clearance?
Well, the president isn't granted clearance. The president is clearance. The objective fact is if the American people select somebody to be president, whether it's Donald Trump or Bill Clinton or George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Joe Biden, the act of selecting them gives them access to all of America's secrets by definition. The president's the person who creates the security system. He's not the person who's subordinate to it. And it has to be that way. Fact is, if in the end we lose all these, and if in the end Joe Biden becomes president, he is president. And that means that he will have all of the prerogatives and power of the presidency.
Roy and Joan from Virginia have a suggestion. With the vaccine on the nation's doorstep, why isn't its arrival widely labeled as the Trump vaccine? He's behind the true success, and it needs to be labeled before the incoming administration takes all the credit for it.
Well, if we lived in a world that was fair, it probably would be called the Trump vaccine, but I somehow don't see NBC News uttering the term the Trump vaccine. Although I will confess, CNN yesterday gave President Trump credit for it and said that this was his great achievement and that he deserved recognition for it. It was a mildly shocking moment in the history of CNN.
Right. I know my question is, If all the states choose to certify their votes, can President Trump still contest this election and take it to the Supreme Court, or is it a done deal at that point?
No, certification actually is the step before most lawsuits. That doesn't preclude him from having all of his legal rights. And the key dates are the 14th of December, when the electors first meet, and then the ballots that they cast. I think it's on the 6th of January. And those are the key dates. And so I think after the 6th, unless no one's gotten 270 electoral votes, at which point it goes to the House and Senate, and they make a decision.
Good morning. My question is not one that involves the urgency of the election, but I have long thought that one of the keys to making our republic better is to have term limits. And I know that was part of the contract with America. And my questions are, do you agree, and do you think that will happen in the relatively near future?
I think I could live with, say, 12-year term limits. I think that you'd have more turnover, you'd have more new blood coming in. I would oppose anything shorter than 12 years because, frankly, it takes a while to learn the legislative process. It's really a complicated business. In an ideal way, the right kind of term limits the next election. And if somebody's a bad member, you ought to go ahead and beat them. But it's very hard to imagine getting the Congress to voluntarily set term limits for itself. But in the various state legislatures, that has happened. So it's conceivable, but I think it's uphill.
Thank you for taking my question. Is there any cohesive plan at the level of GOP, RNC, to set up a national strategy to win elections, given the way these elections happen lately?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, actually, they had a pretty good strategy on the House side. They knew that they wanted to recruit very broadly. They had largest victories for minority groups and for women in the history of the House Republican Party. They went out and really recruited hard to get really good candidates. And they had a strategy really of taking on Pelosi and pitting the local Democrat against Pelosi in a way which seemed to work pretty well. I think that the president had a strategy which came close to emphasize the economy on one hand, to emphasize things like the breakthroughs of the vaccines, and then to emphasize how radical Kamala Harris was and how inevitably radical Biden would be. He relatively followed that, probably did a little more attacking Biden personally than I would have recommended, because it actually, I think, weakened the case. The challenge with Biden was not that he was inadequate. The challenge was that in the end, he was going to represent a very left-wing government, which is what I think we'll see in the next couple of months.
Newt, I'm concerned that the media has just decided that this election is over and that there's nothing that can be done, so that if something big does happen, it will be pushed back and not accepted by the general population. What's your feelings about that?
I think that's a very wise and very sophisticated approach. I agree with you. I think the media was desperate to defeat Trump. The first chance they got to say something, they called it very early. And people need to remember, not a single state has been certified yet. What you have is a coronation by the news media who hate Trump and who would have preferred anybody, I think, to Trump. And of course, they want to create an environment in which people say, well, why are you still counting votes? Well, the answer is, it has nothing to do with Trump. We owe it to the American people to find out how many examples of corruption and dishonesty are embedded in the system. And it would actually, I think, be a disservice to America if Trump conceded too early and didn't insist on completing the vote counts and the appeals process. Every day I learn new examples of how the corruption occurs and what the bad guys are doing. And that's only going to happen if we continue to keep the heat on.
Newt, here's my question. What percentage of Senate Republicans are confused about the idea that the base has expectations to support President Trump and will remain the leader of the party after this election, no matter what? Seems like a lot of them think he's going to go away and they can have business as usual. Love to get your thoughts.
I think overwhelmingly, they think that he will be a dominating figure. Again, you know, 4 years is a long time. If he wants to run again, he would be very, very formidable. but he may also look around and decide, you know, it's been a lot of fun, but it's not how he wants to spend the rest of his life. I think that the values and the policies he stands for will bear the test of time. And I think probably 70 or 80% of the party will be broadly in favor of a Trump vision of the world. But I don't think you should assume automatically that he would win the nomination, nor should you assume automatically that he'd run. So there's plenty of time and space there for other people to come out and do a good job. And frankly, it's good for the party. But if you could get 20 or 30 candidates who think they may want to run for president and get all of them working in 2022 to elect House and Senate candidates, you'd have a lot of energy out there helping the Republican Party. I'm for lots of people having a chance. Go try it out. Give speeches. Raise money. Get better known. Creates a much healthier party. You have many choices. If you find this useful, feel free to send them on to your friends and to encourage your friends to join and be part of the Inner Circle. It's a program I really like, and as you can see today, brings together a lot of different people, a lot of ideas, and we're going to continue developing. So thank you all very, very much, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you to my guests, the founding members of my Inner Circle Club. You can become a member of the Inner Circle by going to newtsinnercircle.com or by visiting our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.